A Map of the World, Disc 12.
Chapter 18. I came back into the fold 4 days after the struggle, and they still hadn't settled on the authentic version. The contest was recounted to me plenty of times with more fire and detail than I'm sure there actually was. Debbie said I threw up before I passed out. The next time Rita told the story, I was vomiting blood and then bile. When I questioned her, she said, "What do you know? You wasn't even there." Hilda, a woman who passed through briefly, spoke with a certain authority because she had 2 bullet wounds on her thigh. "You didn't hear Blondie moaning?" she'd say. She was incredulous at the group's poor observational skills. "She wasn't moaning." "Shut your face. I was right there with my ear in her mouth." In Hilda's version, Dyshett came at me. We wrestled. I was brought to the floor and badly beaten. The others, for the most part, didn't try to hide their confusion about what had taken place. I had ended up in the hospital, in surgery, because a blood vessel had ruptured in the crash and was leaking blood into my brain cavity. That, at least, is how I understood the problem. I had been unconscious, and apparently the doctor tried to call Howard, only to leave messages, he said, with a young girl. The jail authorities didn't knock themselves out to inform either Howard or Rafferty. I knew nothing about the specifics for a few days because no one told me anything. I was shackled to my bed, and there was a guard outside, one of the larger men, just what you'd expect, hairy with unclad women tattooed up and down his arms. I knew my head hurt, and that in all probability, I would live to go back to the airless vault from which I'd come. On the last day, an Iranian doctor explained in the Queen's English just how they had put a burr into my skull to drain the fluid. He comforted me with the fact that it had been a serious procedure, and that I would mend. I did feel, as Hilda later remarked, that I hadn't really been present for much of the trauma. When I finally saw myself in the bathroom mirror at the hospital, it wasn't the bruise on my forehead that startled me as much as my cropped hair. I had always had thick, long hair. I had been vain about my braids, but I also believed that it, the hair itself, was somehow the truest, the best part of me. I like to think it was the feature which described me. "Too bad they had to go so close," the nurse said from behind, as I stared at myself. "It's a shock, isn't it? I've got a scarf you can have, if they'll let you, an extra pink thing to cover all that up when the bandage comes off." By all that, she meant my head. She didn't seem to notice my manacles, and she made conversation as if I was an ordinary person who'd had an accident. I was in the hospital a short time, but in that brief interim I tried to fill up on air and light, silence and darkness. Lizzie's death seemed close again in the hospital setting, and I found myself welcoming the familiar oppressive images only to then fully remember their content. I sat up when I could manage and watched the sky. Despite the constraints, I felt free as a bird, being able to look out a window. The blow seemed to have shifted the contents of my brain so that the heavy portion was up front, the fluff in the back. The dull, continuous ache left me dizzy. If I didn't consciously hold my head straight, I had the feeling it would fall forward to my chest. In addition to the work of balancing the new weight, I couldn't keep from thinking about Howard. I was sure that he would have been notified, and that at any moment he would walk through the door. I kept waiting. I wanted very much to see him without the barrier of the plexiglass. I wanted to lay my hands on him. I thought that with touch, only with my fingers on his skin, would I know clearly what I felt. During my time in jail, I wasn't always sure that Howard and I would weather the storm, and I often tried to think what it was, a single thing, that went deep enough to hold us. I knew that what had brought us together in Ann Arbor was the mysterious chemical bonding that is not rational, eyeball to eyeball, so that we both went to our respective apartments and dreamed each other up, yearning, never straining against the force that drew us right against each other. Emma had been conceived shortly after we met. We had bought the farm, and then Claire came along. There were children and real estate to bind the ties. His parents, Nellie and Walt, had had a strong union, and Howard believed, with a kind of fervor that seemed nearly Christian, that there was a sanctity in marriage to uphold, that the husband and wife were to make their way through the world shoulder to shoulder. I hadn't known anything to speak of about marriage when we met, but I had found his aspirations impossible to resist. Lying in the hospital bed, I thought to myself that my passion for Howard had soon been replaced by something that was stronger than respect, or habit, or maybe even need. It wasn't a simple connection like affinity, because there had been periods when I felt as if I was living with a stranger, that I didn't know or particularly like the man asleep beside me, the man who always got up so early. There were dozens of feelings that came to me in varying strengths as I lay still. I recalled my affection for Howard, my admiration, the attraction I felt to him, and the way he could take me by surprise and amuse me. Those feelings were on the side of what I called love. On the other side, there was rage, irritation, disappointment, boredom. Somewhere in the middle was endurance, stolid and essential as air. I wasn't certain the group of feelings wouldn't cancel each other out, if any of them could possibly be powerful enough to carry me along by his side, shoulder to shoulder. Because I couldn't make out the blur of the next week or month, I tried to see through to the end. I would die, and if I was still married to Howard, I would be buried next to him. Where would we rest our useless bodies? We might not be allowed a plot in the Prairie Center Cemetery, but it would be of little matter, save for our hurt feelings, because Howard would want to be buried with his relatives in Minnesota. Imagine lying down near Nellie, having, even in death, even as a pile of bones, to feel her disapproval. Howard would want to be laid between the two of us, for old time's sake. "Look on the positive side, sweetheart," Nellie might say over Howard's bleached carcass to me. "The worms need to eat, too." I would never feel at home in the Goodwin plot outside of Hastings, Minnesota. In the end, maybe what marriage offered was the determination of one's burial site. We would be laid to rest, and little children would come along in the fall and kick leaves around and jump off the stones while their parents reprimanded them. Emma and Claire would grow up and die and go off and be buried with their husbands. Oh, it was too lonely, too desolate to think about. I sat in my bed while my head pounded, and the guard sat outside chewing his gum. I thought of a time right after we'd moved to Prairie Junction. Emma was a baby. We had put her in her crib in the otherwise empty nursery. When she was sleeping soundly, we went out, locking the swollen door behind us. Howard assured me it would be all right. We would be gone for just a minute. It was so hot, and she was asleep. We had run down the lane in the dark and yanked off our clothes, dropped them in the sand. Howard carried me in the good cool water, kissing my neck and my breasts. He had let me go when we had swum side by side, going under, opening our eyes to the darkness. And I wondered, as I came up into the air, if my mother and father had ever done anything of the kind, swum naked together on a sweltering night, stroke after stroke, going down together into the darkness. I had hoped so hard my teeth began to chatter. And then I hoped, most certainly in vain, for my mother's mother, and her mother before her. I stood in the water, catching my breath, throwing my head back, hoping beyond all the other hopes that my daughter would some day know that particular joy. Lying between the cool hospital sheets, I tried to remember, to feel, the black water on my skin. I remembered being afraid that night at the pond, that Howard, the Howard who was so sure of animal husbandry, auto mechanics, and history, his beautiful face, his hair wet and slicked back, his marmoreal torso. I remember fearing that he was bound to go up in flames with no notice. That night I had wanted to swim to him, and yet I wanted to think of him always there on the dock, safe and waiting for me. I had fluttered my hands and kicked my feet, trying to stay in place, out of my depth. Always my thoughts of the water, of Howard, led me to the farm itself and the worry I had that he might try to sell it. It was irrational, I knew. Rafferty had explained to me that the farm was what we had in our favor, the thing that rooted us to Prairie Center. Howard wasn't prone to impetuous behavior, and he would be able to keep the faith, I always told myself. Keep the faith that we could outlive everyone in Prairie Center, closed up in our house, secure in the woods. I was sure we could outlast everyone, until all the faces pressing against the glass were nothing more than a mild, unpleasant dream. It was impossible to imagine Howard without the farm. I couldn't think what would fill his days and his nights. What would replace the map that was securely lodged in his brain, a weather map complete with every weather possibility? Clouds, cirrocumulus, undulatus, stratus uniformis. A plain old cold front floated before his eyes, even as he looked at the night sky. In my worst moments, I pictured Howard coaxing the shy postmistress down at the Prairie Center P.O. out of her cage with a pail of fresh, warm milk, only because he knew that if he merged their stamp collections, they would make a fortune. Helen, that was her name, and Howard. They belonged together. Emma and Claire would have brothers and be blended. I had learned as a child that it's foolish to take anything for granted, and so I knew that it was possible that in my short absence Howard could fall blindly in love with Postmistress Helen. He would do well with someone who liked to weigh concrete objects and count out change and deliver goods. Mrs. Glevich would say that it served me right, that that's what happened when you let a decent man out of your hands. I tried to imagine taking up with Luther Tritts, the band director, once I was sprung, living a life of exile like the Duchess and Duke of Windsor, quarreling in between our games of blackjack and all on Luke's meager allowance. A fly had somehow made its way up the stairs in the hospital and was buzzing near my tray. I gave it a second look, one of God's creatures, a dirty insect that we took for granted and treated with contempt. How charming he was, washing himself with his feet, how dapper the gray stripes were running down his body. I might take him back to the jail girls as a token from my trip abroad. While nothing was impossible, nothing, not life imprisonment, not death, or the keeping of a fly in a shrine, I wondered if it was remotely possible that something, a shred to be sure, of the old life could be salvaged. The old life. Howard, arms bronzed up to his T-shirt, cultivating the corn, thinking about his cows, the storm systems, the farmers who'd come before him. The Black Hawk War, the wonder of growing vegetable matter from a place as unlikely as the ground. And I, upstairs on the porch, with the shades drawn, dancing by myself. All the while our girls would grow up, making their lives out of the pieces we'd given them. Ordinary life was laced with miracles. I knew that. Had read enough poetry to understand that we are elevated with the knowing. And yet it was difficult to notice and be grateful when one was continually fatigued and irritated. I suppose that unquenchable sense of wonder is what separates us dolts from the saints and the poets. This was the lesson, perhaps, that I was sent to learn. The old life was worth having at any expense. Had Teresa been imprisoned, she would have guessed the moral after 5 minutes. I would know, wouldn't I, when I got out, what things were worthy of complaint? Maybe there was value in going to jail to weigh the feelings I had for Howard, to determine if the scale would tip one way or the other. I had thought so often last summer of the pond all those years ago, when Howard and I swam back and forth that first night in Prairie Junction. I couldn't make heads or tails of the last year, but I could remember and find sense in that single evening in the past. At face value, it had been a dip on a hot night. But it was something else, too. I could see that now. Something on the order of a baptism, a kind of blessing. It had been impossible to see at the time, to understand what was taking place right under our noses. Without minister and feast and candlelight and absolution, our swim had marked a beginning. When I returned to the pod after the incident, an unexpected change had taken place. I came through the door, and just as happened on my first entrance, the girls stopped their talk. They stared unabashedly as I made my way to the cell, with my white bandage wrapped around my head like a squash turban. I looked beaten. My hair was gone. But I did my best to stand up straight. I moved slowly across the floor without looking to the left or to the right. They watched me walk. I had lived, presumably still capable of telling the story, whatever it was, while Dyschett and Janet scratched at the walls of their cells across the corridor. It was Sherry who came to my side just as I got into bed, who gave me a hand. She may have known that I had doctor's orders to rest and as much Demerol as I wanted. "She don't know what hit her," Sherry whispered. "Who?" I said. "Dyschett," she answered. "You took it like a sponge or something. You just soak all of her." She wasn't sure what to call Dyschett's fury. "She's screaming at you something fierce after you knock over. She's screaming at Janet to kick at you." Big dumb Janet was like, "Huh?" "But you was something, all raggy on the floor. But we knowed you got strength inside of you. You wasn't using it, except you was too using it. We've been trying to figure that out ever since." She held my stiff back as I eased down into the mat. "Thank you," I said. "I appreciate it." She squinted at me as if my halo was hurting her eyes. "I don't have any idea what happened," I mumbled. "Some of them, Natasha, Hilda, Rita, they say Dyschett and Janet beat on you. But the way it happens, and I seen every move, Dyschett just about ready to get you, and you do it for her. You take all of her and dump over with it. I tell myself, don't get involved with this scene because there ain't nobody going to see it the same way. I tell myself, the Almighty's taking over this picture. I seen you with the grin on your face like you at heaven's gate, and then you bump over, slam, head goes on the table, and then you fall to the floor. Smack! Head goes on the cement. The way I see it, the whole story is one big trap. Only I can't figure out who got caught." "Dyschett didn't hurt me?" I said. Is that what you're saying? Let's put Debbie's pillow under here, too, she said, lifting my head and sliding the flat pillow under me. She don't need it with all her padding. No, it make Dachette lose her mind a little. She not used to people just taking her right in the face. She been fighting her whole life, and people been fighting back. You sat like you some dead sponge, soaking her up. Maybe you got so full of her, you can't take it no more. You just drop over with all that shit she give off. When the guard asks what happened, she look at him like she a poor little lost lamb who accidentally killed her best school teacher. She don't even know if she did it. She don't even know if she didn't do it. Dachette, she never been in that spot before. I love seeing that girl all confused. That the most beautiful sight, that girl mixed up so she don't know if she going or coming. She spread my blanket over me. You got to get comfortable and rest. No more talking right now. You need something, you call. Afterward, it was dismaying that jail life should just continue. Sometimes I felt as if I'd been on a rocky, slightly dangerous flight. I should have felt relief, maybe a little bravado, laughing off how rough it was, how much worse it might have been. I had apparently won something in the process, and yet the days went on. Time went forward in its indefatigable way, as it had before. Although for a while afterward the girls occasionally argued over the finer points of the mystery beating, they seemed to believe that Dachette was responsible for my bruise and my bandage. Sherry privately assured me that neither Dachette nor Janet had ever touched me. I wanted to believe her version, because in her absurd and compelling story, I was delivered from Dachette's blow by my own failing body, a body that seemed at once weak and wise, knowing to give way at an opportune moment. I was sure that Howard and Rafferty, too, would find it implausible. I had bumped my head hard on the metal table and passed out, and then I fell to the floor and banged it again on the cement. Howard might find certain aspects of the narrative perfectly in character, in particular the fact that I couldn't bump my head without inciting a race riot. For the most part, the others gave me a wide berth, as if I were someone unpredictable, saintly, or loony, they weren't sure which. I didn't show myself much, didn't let on that curled up on my bed under my blue blanket I was nursing my wounds. When Dachette returned to the pod, I was dimly aware that she was subdued and that the old order had crumbled. Janet was packed off somewhere else, four of last week's inmates had moved on, and with a new lot, Sherry came into her own, ordering Debbie to get a Band-Aid if anyone so much as had a hangnail. She was matronly, firm, her generosity expanding by the day in her self-appointed role. She gave Dachette valiums from a stash she had hidden in a sock, and advised her to behave during her sessions with the public defender. She seemed to take it upon herself, for the good of the group, to occupy Dachette by playing endless games of rummy. If Dachette were out at a meeting or asleep, Sherry would visit me as if she were a minister making her rounds. It was more fellowship, certainly, than the Reverend Joseph Neighbor from Prairie Center had been able to muster on my account. Sherry routinely saved half of her sandwich from lunch and brought me candy bars from the vending machine. "You got to keep up your strength," she'd say. "You look like something plucked with that new hairdo, so the least we got to do is fatten you up." I mentioned at one of those bedside chats that although I was sleeping through the daytime drama, I was well aware that she was now the undisputed leader. "Just wait till we get a new warrior in here," she said, shaking her head and laughing. Just wait till Dachette perk up a little. She depressed about her life right now, and she droopy from my medicine cabinet, you know, a little of this, some of that, to calm her down. Once she get back in gear, we can kiss the peace goodbye. What's the matter with her? I asked. She looking at 5 years for scratching that cop, Sherry said. That ain't cheerful news. And you, laying in here all day, I think that sort of spook her. She watching you for signs of life. You some big mystery to her. She don't know if she be afraid, or how much she hate you, or what. It's some big mystery, and she don't like no mystery. That old man she killed in Chicago, he dead, and now she brag about him. But you still laying here, and she don't know if she should brag and strut. She want to, but I think she afraid of you. She afraid you planning to voodoo her again. She one jumpy girl. I think everything that ever happened to her in her life is catching up with her right about now. Would you mind telling her that I have not and will not voodoo her? I said. She leaned over and whispered. I tell her I ain't sure about you. I tell her you laying in here whispering to yourself seems like you saying your spells and mumbo jumbo. That girl, she just about eaten out of my hand these days. I prepared for Rafferty's occasional visits by taking a shower, pinching my cheeks, and putting on clean socks. I remember once as I was getting ready, Sherry, in her capacities as doorman, minister, nurse, and gang leader, called out, "Where are you going?" "My man is here," I said.
"Your man?"
"My man."
"What'd he look like?"
"He has a chronic sinus condition," I said dreamily. "He wears terrible suits of the cheapest magnitude. His hair is slick, like Elvis's, only it's speckled with gray. And his goatee has tobacco stains."
"You sick?"
she asked, coming closer with a look of motherly concern on her face. What I loved about Rafferty, what I felt I surely must have loved about him for all of my life, was the fact that he never once doubted me. When I was taken down to the conference room to meet with him the first time after my arrest, he looked at me and then he shut his eyes, as if for some reason he hadn't expected to see me in my orange togs, as if they were indecent and offended his sensibility.
"I'm sorry," he said.
"No," was all I could say, laughing a little at his surprise. He spit.
"I despise these cases."
As if the words themselves were venomous and he wanted them out of his mouth. He was agitated enough to have trouble snapping open his vinyl briefcase. I knew right away that he had the anger Howard wished for me. "I thought these cases were over, a thing of the 80s. But they keep coming on. They keep coming." Of course, he never looked me in the eye and asked me to say if I'd done it, but I felt that his capacity to know and identify was exact, that he could look at a rare coin and right off say its worth, just as he could quickly size me up and understand that I would never have hurt Robbie or the other boys as I stood accused. "I hate to see you in here," Rafferty said, as if we were old friends and my condition pained him. I never asked him if he was going to win my case or what he thought my chances were. He was an eccentric man whose personal effects looked to have been frozen about 1957. It was illogical, I knew, but I also felt that he was someone who never passed judgment. I realize now that I always sense that quality in people about whom I feel rapturous. In our meetings, I tried to look clearly back over the last year, to tell him everything in proportion. I had hit Robbie, and in my mind, both he and I had grown monstrous. Although he was a thin, undernourished child, in my dreams he often had the constitution of a punching bag, something you can knock down all you want, and it will always pop right up again. Mrs. Mackesy, in my mind's eye, was golden, all flickers and dazzle, slithering down the hall to get her son. For Rafferty, I tried to draw them as I had first seen them, nothing more nor less than the sick, neglected boy and his preoccupied mother. Although Rafferty felt that Robbie Mackesy's case was relatively simple, there were three other boys who had come forward: Norman Fraser, Anthony Jenkins, and Tommy Giddings. There were also several other children who were being evaluated by the Child Welfare Agency, although Rafferty didn't tell me just how many until later. My records showed that I had seen the three boys once or twice during the school year, but I didn't remember them without some prompting. There were 700 children at Blackwell Elementary, and I had never thought that I might have to keep them straight. "Is there any procedure you do that could be misconstrued?" Rafferty asked, his hands folded, his big pen at rest on his empty legal pad. In all those months he worked on my case, I only remember him writing something down once. I may have misjudged Rafferty, investing in him qualities that were no doubt preposterous for any criminal lawyer. It doesn't matter now. I liked the way he wasn't afraid to watch me. He kept his eyes on me as I tried to think, not as if he were a vulture waiting for me to stumble, not as if he were trying to determine innocence or guilt, but as if it was his duty to fix his loving gaze on his client. I think I believed in him, just as a young child believes in his father. He would be there, I was sure of it, keeping watch, even if the sky fell down and covered us like a tarp. "If they're sick, I have them lie on a cot," I said. "Teresa says that when she was in school, the nuns used to warn the girls not to go on a date to a restaurant where white tablecloths were used, because it would remind a boy of bedsheets and drive him wild with desire. Do you suppose a cot is suggestive to a 6-year-old boy?" Rafferty rolled his eyes and threw his head back as if he was gargling. "I really don't do much," I continued. "I'm only a nurse. I can take temperatures and look down someone's throat and see if it's red, and then if they say it hurts, I send them home. If the parents are at work, the children spend the day on the cot or return to class. During health week, they all come in and get weighed and measured. The scale is one of those massive upright contraptions with ominous black weights waiting to fall on someone's toes. I don't know. Maybe everything is frightening. Last year for health, the 8th grade science teacher wanted me to come in and talk to the class about how AIDS is transmitted, as if the uniform gives me the authority to speak about disease. Sometimes I'm in a hurry. I have to do a lot in the 3 hours I'm there, and I'm sharp. I tell them to hold still, to be quiet, to watch their manners. Maybe anything can be misconstrued, so that one thing eventually becomes another. I mean, in such a way that it's completely changed. Down in that barren cubicle, it seemed that Rafferty would sit across from me and listen for as long as my mouth opened and shut. Maybe it isn't possible to move an inch without being misunderstood. That must be a relief in law, that for everything there is a rule. He laughed out loud and then said, "Yes, right, Alice. A relief, all those rules. Oh, absolutely." "But you see the entire spectrum in school," I went on. "That's what's good about it. We have the undeclared lesbian gym teacher, the homophobic principal, the bleeding heart liberal teaching social studies, the right-wing Christian sneaking in his stuff in earth science." "But can you think of anything specific?" Rafferty prodded. "Yes, yes. I can think of thousands of specific things,
Some I did, some I dreamed, some I feared. I lie quaking when I remember certain days. I was walking down the hall last spring, and the gym teacher, as a matter of fact, Miss Oren, called me in to take a look at a girl's back, a junior high girl who was changing in the locker room. Miss Oren was concerned about this girl's spine. She was having them parade around for some kind of posture exam, but you have to understand, I'm an LPN. I don't know anything. I just ran my hand down the girl's back, the way I would if it were my daughter, to see if I could feel ribs in the wrong place. I only know about scoliosis because I was evaluated for it when I was a teenager. My father may have thought that I was so isolated and withdrawn, like a Victorian heroine, that I probably at least had gout. I remember leaving the locker room, feeling the girls' eyes on me, knowing that they were going to start whispering about the homo gym teacher, the homo nurse. Junior high girls are like savages, you know? I tried to wave my left hand with my wedding ring around to remind them that I'm Mrs. Goodwin. But I knew they'd talk about us all the same. Sometimes I used to have the urge to crack up in front of those girls, to rave about the passionate crushes I'd had on women teachers when I was young. But how, as I grew older, it was dear ecstatic copulation that spurred me on. Do you see what I mean? They were so snide and sure in their disgust that one somehow wanted to knock them off their perches. Rafferty nodded, blowing his stuffy nose into a red bandana. After I looked at the records, I remembered that Norman Fraser, a kindergartner, had come to my office because of a very loose and bloody tooth. He seemed to be one of those volatile children, like Emma, who can't take the unexpected in stride. His tooth was hanging by a thread, his bloody saliva slipping down his chin as he howled. I'm sure the teacher sent him to me because he was disrupting the class. Am I supposed to go find a picture of a tooth? Show him the roots? Try to educate? I asked Rafferty. One child is on the cot throwing up. Another is waiting for medicine. I don't have time. Norman was hysterical. Nothing to do but hold him around his stomach with one arm and, reaching around with the other, pull out the tooth. It was so loose it came away with a pluck. It was a pluck, not a pull. I didn't even wear my gloves, as I should have, to protect myself from his blood. He was so surprised he stopped in the middle of his screech. We put the tooth in an envelope, and he went back to the classroom. Howard thought it was terrible that I had violated the child's body. Once he made some comment to Emma and Claire that they should watch their teeth. The remark bothered me more than I let on. Norman was so busy screaming he hadn't really noticed until I had the tooth in my hand. "That's all you know of him?" Rafferty asked. "Yes," I said. The only thing I remembered about Anthony Jenkins, another of the boys, was that he had skinned his knee and I had poured disinfectant over the gritty wounds. He had trembled with the pain and growled deep in his throat. Rafferty got a hold of a class picture so I could see what the third boy, Tommy Giddings, looked like. And still it sparked no memory. According to my log, I had given him a dose of amoxicillin for an ear infection in October. They all claimed that I had shouted, spanked, hit them across the face, held them down, that I was pernicious and preyed upon them with the greed and toothiness of a shark. At one of our meetings, when we were trying to find any possible association between the boys and Robbie Mackesy, Rafferty leaned over the table and asked me if I was ever afraid. It was an early session, before my run-in with Dichette. I looked at the pale yellow cinder block wall, wondering what I should say, and also relishing for a moment his steadfast attention. Did he mean, I wondered, was I afraid of death? My girls have an animal terror of death, as I did at their age. But I had begun to think that I had lost that particular instinct. I wanted to avoid dying, not least so that Emma and Claire wouldn't have to go through the trauma of having a dead mother. I had seen enough death to know that it isn't anything more startling than taking a next breath. My best and fondest hope for the hereafter was that there was some kind of design and that it was trustworthy. Life on Earth, filled with uncertainty and change, seemed far more difficult than what lay beyond the grave. "Not afraid, exactly," I said to Paul. "There's so much good, and it's been taken away." I may have been whispering because he said, "What?" "I miss the farm," I said. Rafferty's clerk spent several weeks digging up information on the boys, trying to find out if they'd been in the same class, or the same neighborhood, or daycare, or church school. I don't know how he discovered that the four of them were on the same t-ball team during the month of June, and that it was highly likely that they occasionally spent time at one another's houses. Tommy Gidding's mother was a waitress at Dolphin Bay, the restaurant Carol Mackesy managed. Anthony's mother was the sister of Mrs. Mackesy's hairdresser. It seemed incredible that even Robbie could have fanned the flames and turned the boys against me. That Carol Mackesy could have done so was another matter altogether. "Can you think of a common thread with the boys?" Rafferty asked me. "Something that would have pulled them in the same direction." I imagined Carol feeding Norman and Robbie, Anthony and Tommy, hot dogs with day-glow orange cheese spread from a can in zigzags over the wiener. She might think that she was a good mother to be able to reproduce exactly, down to the last zig, the picture on the can. Although she could have had a bright kitchen with an island, sparkling copper pans, framed prints of fruit, I pictured her in a poorly lit room with dark cabinets and a red sheen, nearly aglow, coming from a fake brick wall. "What do you boys think of the school nurse, that Mrs. Goodwin?" she might have idly asked as she poured them Hawaiian punch on an afternoon only days after Lizzie's funeral. "She's mean," Norman would say. "She pulled my tooth out." "She pulled your tooth out? She went in and yanked out your tooth?" "She held me hard around the stomach. I couldn't get away. And then she reached in and dug my tooth out. It wasn't even loose. She probably would have taken all my teeth if I didn't scream and run away. She has a pair of pliers, a gigantic pair of pliers in her desk drawer." "I always kick her," Robbie might have offered. "Does Mrs. Goodwin do the same awful things to you that she does to Robbie?" "She rips my pants off of me," Robbie would have shouted, giving them a quick demonstration. "My mom says we're going to get a pile of money from her because she did that. She killed a girl, too." "Put that thing back in where it belongs," Mrs. Mackesy might have said in anger, before she realized that the school nurse had made a little exhibitionist out of him. "Come here, pumpkin," she said, going to him, putting her arms around him as he stiffened. "She did that to me once," Anthony Jenkins cried, remembering the time his sweatpants were torn clean through and I had taken them off so I could clean the wound. "More chips, boys? Soda? Anyone ready for a Twinkie?" Robbie, still within the circle of his mother's embrace, said, "We're going to be so rich, my mom says we'll get a sports car, the kind with a roof." "What did she do to you, Anthony? I can't believe this. She's hurt other boys, too?" Robbie burst from her arms, charging at the back door, shouting, "Them cars go 90 miles. Vroom!" "Slow down, Tiger." From the porch, through a small window, he called into the kitchen, "She licked my pee-pee." Did she do that to you boys? Mrs. Mackesy asked. You don't need to be afraid to tell. When someone touches you and hurts you, like Mrs. Goodwin has, it's so important to tell someone. We know it's happened. We know what she is. You only have to say one little word and we'll know the rest. There were days, she was getting upset now, having to blink away the tears, when she wouldn't let me take Robbie home. We all know what she is. Only you can help do the important job of making sure Mrs. Goodwin never sees another boy, never hurts another one of you. It's your job to help us get her. This town will be so thankful to you four boys because you saved us from a person who is disturbed, twisted. It's starting to make sense, I said to Rafferty, knowing that as far as proof went, Mrs. Mackesy in her kitchen was as solid as a hallucination. Do you think Lizzie's death tied into the charge? Rafferty asked. He always waited for my answer with his chin resting on his folded hands. I never thought, until afterward, that he was getting paid for his time, that my reveries were costly. Still, his questions, his watchful eye, forced my memory. Was it something specific that triggered the charge? He probed. It was as if he had the power of the hypnotist, that he need only snap his fingers to make me sleep or wake. I could see into the hospital lounge right after Lizzie had been brought to the emergency room. I could see Mrs. Mackesy in her chair leafing through a magazine. I had forgotten that she'd been there. She had been with me, like a shadow, while I waited to hear. I had been dripping wet, and I had sat on the edge of the sofa, doubled over, praying. I must have looked as desperate as I felt. I remembered, too, that I had run right past Carol and Robbie at the funeral as I fled. Was it Carol who put it into his head just as I streaked past them? Might she have mused aloud, "Is that woman out of her mind?" She might have realized it was I and said to Robbie, "Mrs. Goodwin looks as if she'd killed the girl. How can they let someone like that work in an elementary school?" So much of this, I'm afraid, is a feeling, I said to Rafferty. Instead of looking at me with contempt or scoffing, he nodded, saying, "It's only taken me about 10 years to understand that that's where every case begins. Not with facts or a body, a few tattered pieces of evidence, but with a couple of people and then a whole range of possibility. Their pride, their love, their lust, their sense of injury, vengeance, greed, despair, you name it. This is what I think might have happened, I began then, not too long after the funeral, in Mrs. Mackesy's kitchen. When Rafferty and I met about a week and a half after my fainting spell, he took one look at me and with his normal adenoidal fire and indignation declared that we had reached the limit. "Why didn't they call me?" he shouted, beating the table with his fist. I shrugged and said that I thought they'd tried to get in touch with Howard. But he knew as well as I did that they didn't go out of their way to keep the families up to date. My bruise wasn't as colorful as it had been, and I assumed I could just say, "I bumped my head," and leave it at that. "You don't get a bruise the size of a grapefruit from bumping your head," he protested. "It's funny," I said, cutting him off, "about being afraid. You asked me about that a couple of weeks ago. I thought for a while that I was going to get pounded. It wasn't that that I feared. What's frightening is that I can't love those girls."
"For God's sake."
"No," I said. "Teresa would find it within herself to love them.
She would understand what they were given at the start, understand why they're so angry. I'm more afraid of what I don't have, that deep down, you know, way down, there isn't really much of anything.
You're reading the wrong novels, Rafferty said. You are not required to love your fellow inmates.
He went on to lecture me at length about how we have to protect ourselves against those who, for whatever reasons, are barbarians.
Save your love for your daughters, he ordered.
I said that, of course, Emma and Claire gave me reason to be afraid. I had wept when they were born, each in their turn, because of semi-automatic weapons on the street, stockpiles of hazardous waste, terrorist acts, hatred, all of the horrors which we bequeath to our children. My general sorrow in relation to the human condition was nothing compared to my new and specific grief over the fact that my daughters' lives were forever changed. I had sworn I would never do to my children as my mother had done to me, that I would never abandon them, and yet I had, for all intents and purposes, left them. Even if I was let go, even if we moved to Australia, they would always know that I had been responsible for something that permanently altered each of us. They would always feel, even if no one else knew, that they carried with them a stigma. There wasn't really any place we could go where we wouldn't suffer from the knowledge that evil had been done to us, and that we, in our turn, had injured those around us. It was nearly a week after my hospitalization that Debbie came out of herself long enough to ask me a personal question. It was a relatively quiet morning, each of us at the work of holding ourselves together. Debbie shuffled into our cell after breakfast and stood, staring at me while I read. When she realized I wasn't going to look up, she said right out, "How old are your children?" That she might ask me something was so uncharacteristic, I found at first that I couldn't answer.
What?
I finally said.
You keep getting letters from your girls. They draw you pictures. I just wondered how old they were.
I hadn't, up to that point in my stay, showed much emotion in front of Debbie, except in relation to her own troubles. I felt my mouth start to move. I wanted very much to control myself. Debbie had the sense to avert her eyes while I tried to master my poor trembling lips. For several minutes she stood looking out at the day room, pulling on her nose. To my dismay, I found myself sobbing into my lap. I was apparently making enough noise to attract attention because pretty soon Sherry was poking her head around the corner.
What this fuss about? What you be doing, Debbie girl, going on and making her cry?
I just asked her a question, Debbie squeaked.
You missing your babies? That it?
Sherry asked, sitting down next to me. She pointed at Debbie.
Go get some tissues.
Sherry was 19 years old. She had been driving the getaway car when her boyfriend held up a handy pantry. He'd wounded two people and nearly gotten away with $600. I couldn't stop crying. I felt as if a ball bearing had come loose inside my head, that it banged from side to side every time I blinked. If I was sent to prison and my children got a stepmother in due course, I would still be a blight to them. If there was a plea bargain and I pleaded guilty for a lesser sentence, child welfare might barge in and take the girls away from Howard. If I lost the trial, I would be in prison for years. My absence was a wound. I might just as well have cut off a limb or put out an eye.
I miss my babies, too, Sherry said, slipping her arm around me.
I was rigid in her arms as she moved back and forth, trying to rock me.
I got my three little dickens at my mama's house.
I remember wanting very much to protest, to insist that someone 19 years old couldn't possibly know my pain, that our ages, our experience, our upbringing were so dramatically different we were virtually not of the same species. I remember trying to say that. My head was throbbing and I couldn't make the words to tell her that she knew nothing.
"You have 3 babies?" Debbie asked.
Sherry stared at her.
"You in awe today or something?"
"Well, I..."
"Ain't she, though?" Sherry said, trying to draw me out. "It's like she noticing we made of bones instead of cement.
Congratulations, girl. 3 babies, that's right. Dante, Jamella, Michael J. 1, 2, 3. They always say jail ain't no vacation, but for me it is, that's for sure."
She laughed her big belchy laugh.
"Don't let Dachette fool you," she said. "She had a baby boy when she was 14, a baby girl a year later, but they both got took away to foster care. She say she don't mind, but that ain't no shit but talk. She go out and bust herself buying fancy presents for their birthdays. She got her girl a gold necklace with a diamond the size of my butt."
I stood up then, dried my eyes on my sleeve, and thanked Sherry. My head hurt so much I couldn't see. I needed my children not to know me, not to remember that it had been I who made their world smash, as much as I needed to breathe near them, to encircle them, to keep them safe. I leaned over the toilet, trying to choke down the grief, as if what was inside was likely to come ripping up my throat, as if it was something that could be purged and flushed away. After Debbie and Sherry went into the day room, I lay on my stomach and looked at the stack of drawings the girls had made. Claire made scribbles, and Emma drew stick self-portraits in triangle dresses with funny little club feet pointing in the same direction. I smelled the drawings and held them to my cheek because the paper always seemed as if it should be directly related to them. If only I could look more closely or read in a way that was just beyond my ability, the girls would be there, underneath the paper. I didn't ever seem to remember the keen disappointment I always felt, and each time there was mail delivery, I opened their letters with great expectation. As I lay in bed, I tried to study the pictures objectively, to see if I could tell if the girls were scarred in any way. Emma's portraits included feet and fingers, and I tried to remember if that wasn't a sign that a child was well-adjusted, had a sense of self-worth. Claire's lines had been made with a free hand, and she used a good deal of color. I thought that a child who was suffering would surely use somber tones and draw spirals that circled into a tight knot. I tried to will the girls to be fine and well and unscathed and unharmed. I closed my eyes and assumed the tense, prayerful attitude I'd used to no avail in the hospital. The following morning, we were eating our scoop of oatmeal with milk and sugar pre-poured, a dirty slice of cantaloupe, orange juice, and cold coffee. For some reason, Dachette had already been out of the pod. No one looked up or paid any attention when she was buzzed into the day room. She sat down at her usual place at the other table. She seemed to take care to keep her distance, to avoid eye contact. After the meal, she went into Sherry's cell to play cards. I had a headache and spent most of the morning lying on my bed trying to sleep. Debbie sat on the floor cross-legged, rocking forward and back as she listened to music on her headset. At lunch, Dachette sauntered over to the table where I was eating and straddled the stool, her side to me, her profile obscured by her mass of braids. A woman named Carla, who was in for fraud, was explaining how her boyfriend's credit card scam worked for years before he got caught. I assumed that Dachette was interested in how to go about the business.
I was nibbling at my hamburger, reading my college alumni magazine, which Howard had sent me in a brown envelope along with the L.L. Bean catalog. A man named Robert J. Harrison, class of 67, had figured out how to grow plastic by genetically engineering a potato. The potato itself produces plastic in the ground. One of the problematic aspects of making the technological wonder a reality is the fact that the plastic could get mixed up in the food chain. I dabbed a French fry into a puddle of ketchup, imagining our golden Guernseys putting their head down in their pasture to graze the perfect lush green grass, only to find that it was fake. "How many kids you got?" Dyshed asked, turning around to face our group, looking straight at me. "Why is everyone asking me that question?" I whined into my hamburger bun. I wished to continue thinking about the tuber that was going to be genetically engineered to grow vinyl tablecloths with or without flower patterns. I didn't want her to know that I had been diminished by our fight, such as it was. The others thought I had come out ahead, but they were mistaken. I didn't want her to know that there were days I couldn't see straight. And I didn't want her to know that I loved Howard in a way that I was sure she would never love anyone. I had a life full of marvels, and she wasn't going to get so much as a glimpse of it. He and I had mapped a course in which work and love were to go together. She wouldn't be able to conceive of such a commitment. We had invested our lives in our children, and the gifts we were giving them were for their heads and their hearts. Emma and Claire weren't merely showcases for expensive jewelry. "I don't want to talk about them," I said. "Excuse me," she said, bending her arms so that her hands, palms up, came to her shoulders. "So, like stores had his name on their lists," Carla was saying in her lesson on fraud. "You know, how they do for people who write bad checks." I felt a violent shudder in my abdomen again, and I swallowed my hamburger as fast as I could in hopes that the bun would staunch the sobs. "What's their names?" Dyshed said. "You can tell me that." She was blurry across the table from me. "A boy you got, or what? A girl?" "No," I said, the awful sharpness and heft of the thing in my stomach lurching up, falling back, lurching up again. "No," I said. I left the table and went to my cell, and I sat on the bed, doing breathing exercises meant for giving birth. I tried to focus on a speck on the wall, to feel as if I was pouring what was inside myself into the black dot on the cinder block, filling the infinite space behind that smallest of portals until I was empty. It was as I tried again and then again to focus on that speck that I recalled the day and the time. Howard was going to come soon for his weekly visit. He, too, would see my pink bandana and wonder why it fits so snugly over my head. I would try to distract him by saying, "Remember the night we swam together in the pond, Howard? Remember how we moved so effortlessly through the water, holding each other as if we were one body? That was the beginning, wasn't it?" When I went down to see him that afternoon, and when I came to my station and reached for the phone, I saw in that instant behind him Emma and Claire looking into the communications room. Without thinking, I tried to get through the window, as if I thought the girls being there meant the glass would dissolve. They were so beautiful. They were wearing new sundresses and their clean hair was shining. I hadn't, for a month and a half, been able to count on the fact that they were real. And now there they were, wonderful and alive, curious about the operators, as if the outing was a trip to a museum. I was so glad, and I felt a rush of gratitude toward Howard for knowing, despite my command, that I needed to see them. He was standing up, shouting into the phone, trying, it seemed just then, to keep me from seeing. I couldn't think why he was blocking the view. He was wearing a blue shirt, looking like a dark shadow in the window, like some ominous figure coming down the street in a cartoon. I was going to say so, into the phone, and then I was going to shout how glad I was to see the girls. I needed to look beyond him, if he would only get out of the way, and I needed to say the lines I had been working on. Remember the pond that night, Howard? Is it love that connects us? Is that what it is? I never knew that the feeling I have is regular old love because it's so intricate. Perhaps there's another name for it, one we don't yet know. I used to think that love was simple and noticeable, like rain falling, so that just as you'd look at your skin and say, water, you would also wake in the morning and say, love. But it has been underneath, this new and old thing I feel, subterranean, silent and steady, like blood, rushing along and along without often making itself known. When I looked at him, he was jabbing his finger at the window, as if he meant to poke me. His face was red, bilious. I had never seen him with such an expression, his frown running all the way into his neck. I love you, Howard, I tried to say into the window, but he was spitting and frothing, erupting into what looked very much like anger. The room began to lean and spin, slowly, like a merry-go-round just heating up, going at a drowsy pace so that you could still jump aboard if you had your ticket. I wasn't sure then that the girls were really there, that they weren't some kind of mirage. I had to get out before I tipped over. The guard tried to make me go back to my station, but he finally let me out when I said, "There's no one here I know."
This ends Disc 12.